From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book about caring for those at the end of life, Ira Byock says, in an era of extraordinary medical technology, it's harder to die than it ever has been. It can be painful, dehumanizing, prolonged. But if you think things are bad now, just take a look at what Byock calls the demographic tidal wave approaching. It won't be long before older people will outnumber younger people on the planet. Rather than despair, Byock says the historic challenges come with historic opportunities. He says the country can collectively transform the way we die. It's going to take some practical changes, he says, as well as some cultural rethinking. Today in the program, Ira Byock is joining us to talk about his book, the title of which reflects his ideal, The Best Care Possible. Join us after the news. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. In his new book, Dr. Ira Byock breaks down the problems with end-of-life care in an era of medical innovation and technology. He says the healthcare system is great at treating disease, just not so well, doesn't do so well at dealing with death. It's harder to die than it ever has been, he says. It can be painful and dehumanizing. His book expresses his hope that the country can collectively transform the way we die. But he says it's going to take some practical changes as well as some cultural rethinking. Today in the program, Dr. Byock is with us to talk about how you treat people less like medical cases and more like individuals, when you use technology, and when you let nature take its course. His book reflects his ideal. It's called The Best Care Possible, A Physician's Quest to Transform Care Through the End of Life. We invite you to join the conversation if you have questions or comments or stories. 801-585-WEST is the number to join us. Our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. Dr. Ira Byock is Director of Palliative Medicine at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center in New Hampshire. He's also a professor at Dartmouth Medical School. The Best Care Possible is his third book, we should say. His others include Dying Well and The Four Things That Matter Most. And Dr. Byock is joining us today from a studio at Dartmouth College in Hanover, New Hampshire. Dr. Byock, welcome. Thanks very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Doug.
I wanted to start with something that you write. You mention in an author's note at the beginning of the book that the book is not intended to be reportage. It's stories. It's experiences. And it's first person. I'm not sure if that's entirely unique, but it's interesting. It's personal in some ways for you. Is that fair to say?
Oh, it's very personal. This is what I do day in and day out, and you know, I bring my whole self to the practice of medicine. So it would be impossible to write this book without being sort of transparent about what I'm thinking and what I'm feeling as I go through a busy clinical days and, frankly, also teaching residents and medical students throughout the course of my practice.
Mm. It's interesting in the book you write about how it's love that motivates everything you do and teach. And you write about how even though you're not an observant Jew, but that sense of life comes from your Jewish roots and your Jewish beliefs, and that seems to inform your attention to this subject, I guess.
You know, it's so true, and I think I make people uncomfortable when you talk about loving patients, but there's nothing in any way unwholesome about this. Love has always been the driving impetus of healthcare. Certainly doctors, nurses, social workers, chaplains, all healthcare providers are motivated at our basis by an affinity for other people, as a connection to other people. That's what feeds us. This is not car mechanics. You know, this is really about caring for whole human beings, and it's absolutely wholesome and would be, frankly, unnatural if we didn't have some sense of love of the people that we're actually caring for.
You've been thinking about this a long time, writing about it a long time. When did it first occur to you? When did the idea first come to you? Was it something that you saw, or just the sort of the result of a collection of things that you were seeing?
You know, what sucked me into this was back in my internship in California. I was working in Fresno, California, in a boat gray, very busy public health hospital called Valley Medical Center. Many of our patients were undocumented Spanish-speaking farm workers with very deep roots into their in families, very strong family, and often very religious people, by the way. And I thought our medical center, this, you know, public health hospital, did a very good job in almost everything we did. We were really proud of it, but we didn't take care of people very well at the end of life. So I got involved really to keep people from having to wait 6 hours to get their Tylenol with codeine refilled in the emergency department, or to, you know, to prevent bowel obstructions when it was just constipation, you know, just the basics. Mm. What sucked me in was that occasionally, even just looking at trying to avoid crises, I would meet somebody on the wards and I would say, you know, Mr. Rodriguez, how are you doing today? And he knew, because we had just had the conversation the day before, that his life expectancy was in, you know, weeks. And Mr. Rodriguez would look up, make eye contact with me and say, I'm well, doctor. How are you? Or I'd meet a family who came back after the matriarch of their family had just died, and they'd come back specifically to talk to me or one of the other members of this little hospice we had put together, and they'd say something along the lines of, you know, when we heard Mom was going to die, it was the worst news we could possibly imagine, but this last month, doctor, was one of the best months we've ever had as a family. Mm. Initially, I didn't have any place to put that. Nothing in my undergraduate education, nothing in medical school, nothing in my training to that point had given me a place to understand anything positive that somebody would say who was dying or had just lost a loved one. And initially I thought with Mr. Rodriguez, well, you know, it's the morphine. Sure, he's getting a little buzz on the morphine, or it's the steroids. He's euphoric.
Yeah.
But after hearing something along those lines a half a dozen times, it finally dawned on me that the world was trying to teach me something, that people could say they were well within themselves, even acknowledging that their time in this life was short. That has really, you know, what that means and how I can foster that has been really a motivating force in my professional career. I'm not primarily a researcher, but some of the research I have done has been in how one actually measures subjective quality of life when somebody is nearing the very end of life.
Yeah. So we've separated those two ideas, right?
That,
so we see death as it can't in any way be good. It represents an essential failure, I guess.
Right. We don't know. I mean, I dislike that term, the good death,
yeah.
Because for one thing, death is beyond life. And
right.
I don't know what's good about it.
Right.
You know, dying is a part of living. And my first book, which you mentioned, is called Dying Well.
Right.
That phrase is really interesting because when you first hear it, well is an adverb that, you know, describes the process or the experience of dying. It's more challenging to our mindset and frankly to our culture to hear the word well as an adjective describing the person who's dying. Mm-hmm. Can somebody die well? You know, can they be well as a human being, well within themselves during this period of time that they are physiologically dying? Well, in fact, I decided I had to tell stories of real people who told me something about them being well during this time, and sometimes even becoming more well within themselves and within their family, even as their life was ending. That's part of our human endowment. That's part of the anthropology of our human experience that is not attended to in our general culture and Doug, it's really not attended to in medical culture and medical training. So we're sort of, you know, shortchanging, mm-hmm. I think, or lopping off part of the human endowment, which is our birthright. And there's no ill intention here.
Yeah.
But our healthcare system really is a disease treatment system, not a system that takes care of the health of whole persons.
It's important for you to say that this is no one's fault, because you do mention that in the book. And that's not the idea of the book, blaming people
No.
for it. Just acknowledging that this is what it is.
You know, we love life. And you set it up beautifully by saying, you know, I am a cultural Jew. I was raised Jewish. I'm proud of it. But, you know, if there's an agenda to the Jewish experience, it's celebration of life. You know, we toast at celebrations to life, l'chaim. Many Jews wear the symbol for the chai, a Hebrew symbol that is the symbol for life.
Right.
That's the ethos that I was brought up in, and it's the spirituality, at least for the sect or the demographic Judaism that I was brought up in, really is all about culture, and it's about, you know, family and culture and the celebration of life, far more than it has to do with a deity or rituals, frankly, in my upbringing.
You say in the book that the experience of dying has changed over the course of history. And I get that idea from the point of view that medical technology and innovation has just prolonged life. I get it from that perspective. So that in that sense, the experience has changed. But has it changed in other ways too? As it maybe as a result of that? Does that make sense?
Yes. I think listening to my parents, who were born in the early part of the 20th century, 1917, 1922, they describe to me how in the mid 1930s and early 1940s, all of a sudden, people started coming back from the hospital basically well, with things that would have killed them earlier, bad pneumonias, urinary infections, kidney failures, you know, and people needing shortly thereafter. You can just imagine how ICUs came into existence. Heart attacks were no longer quite so quickly lethal. Then we had diuretics, and congestive heart failure no longer killed people immediately. And as we progress through the accelerating pace of advances in medical treatment, antibiotics, but also cardiology, surgery, it just keeps going.
Yeah.
Nowadays, people live often for decades, at least for years, with diseases that used to kill people quite quickly. Congestive heart failure is one. Kidney failure is an obvious other. But now we've extended it. You know, most cancers now are cured. Mm. Those that aren't cured, people live with for at least months and sometimes years, and for most of that time, quite well. When you look at the quote-unquote average person in their 80s these days, they may have two or three or more diagnoses that would have been lethal as short a time ago as the middle of the 20th century. Mm. Now, all of that is to be celebrated. You know, in my practice, I use medical science and technology daily in my personal life and my family's life. We use it, thankfully. I'm so glad we live in this, you know, century, and this third millennium is remarkable. However, the problem is that we have yet to make even one person immortal.
Mm.
And so as a health system and as a physician, but also I think as a society and culture, we need to figure out now, what does dying well look like? What does a robust, wholesome, healthy last chapter of life look like in these utterly unprecedented times in which we live?
So what did it used to look like? Do you know what I mean? In the days before, you know, we had technologies that would prolong our lives. I mean, we've always been afraid of death. It's one of those existential fears. So what was the difference?
But it was so much more common. It was so much more familiar. One of the epiphenomenon, it wasn't the intention, but one of the things that's happened as we've had all this technical prowess is that we've sort of segregated illness and caregiving and dying. You know, we've learned, and I would say mislearned as a culture, that the best care is always in the hospital. So we send people to the hospital. And, you know, through 98% of the time, it is the best care. And if you really, really want the best care, well, you want your loved one in an ICU. We've learned as another lesson here that more treatment is always better care. But if you think about it, if we're mortal, if at some point in time we're not going to get out of this one alive, to use a movie phrase, mm-hmm. then at some point in time, more treatment for your disease stops being better care for you as a person. And we have to make that shift. So dying has become segregated. We've segregated it to doctors and nurses. We've medicalized the end of life when, frankly, it used to be a family and community affair. And unfortunately, we've also done this with frail elders. So often now, frail elders are segregated to nursing facilities, which, you know, I thank the people, my colleagues who work in nursing, skilled nursing facilities, nursing homes all the time. But as a society, we're not treating people who live in nursing homes very well. We're not treating the employees very well. It's sort of a national disaster from my perspective, what they're paid and how short staffing is in nursing homes. It doesn't honor the inherent dignity of the people who live there. But it also sequesters from the general public and our culture the frailties of age and the difficulties of care.
So you write in the book that this transformation is needed in our society and in our culture. And I wanted to get at what you figure that means. I mean, does it mean that we have to sort of come to a new way of talking about this, thinking about this? I mean, and how do you do that? Is it a conversation that we have? Is it, you know, what do you do?
I think there's many, many ways that we need to do this. Just a few. Obviously, the way that I want to do it is I tell stories of real people and then try to unpackage them so that I can explain the implications of those stories to the readers or to the listeners, that they can get a sense of how something in public policy, some regulation or law, adversely impacts the actual lived experience of patients and families. One of the ways.
Wait. Let me just go back there because I think that's really important, and we're going to work through these in some ways. So it's the story. It's the story. So it's the idea of it's academic. If it's just a policy, but if it's a story, that's the connection, maybe.
You know what it is? It's imagination.
Yeah.
I mean, imagination limits us both on the upside and the downside. On, you know, for one thing, when someone we love is seriously ill, we cannot imagine anything worse than them dying. Mm. But our imagination fails us because I got to tell you, there are worse things than having someone you love so dearly die.
Right.
Most basically, there is having someone you love dearly die badly, suffering as he or she dies. And maybe even worse than that is later realizing that much of their suffering was unnecessary. On the other side, our imagination fails us because we can't imagine anything possible that could be of value during this time of life we call dying. And in fact, despite the fact that dying is hard, unwanted, often tragic, concomitant with the tragedy and the sadness, there often are things of real value to the individual who is ill and to their family during this time of life. And if we overly medicalize this time of life, and if we only see the suffering and the medical problems, the physiology and the pharmacology of the whole thing, then we lose the essence of the human experience and the, you know, and the family experience that I think is really the fundamentals. I often say, you know, illness and dying are only partly medical. They have medical implications and aspects, but they are mostly and profoundly personal for the individual and family. That in our if we were able to grow the rest of the way up as a society and as a culture, we would figure out a way to use the best of medical care, but also honor the personal.
Mm. You know, there was a piece written by Dr. Atul Gawande who writes about similar things that you have. And he talks about in those final days, we've in the modern era, we've taken away the last words that a person offers.
Right.
That seems like that's what you're getting at as well. That personal connection doesn't exist in some cases anymore.
That's right. And I think that really robs us of such poignant, precious, valuable parts of the human experience. I don't want to romanticize this. I'm not trying to glorify this time of life. It's often difficult, tragic. It's sometimes quite gritty. But but we ought to be able to hold those two thoughts in mind. Something can be terribly hard and unwanted and yet still have great value for the person and family. If you just think about it, so often how somebody dies becomes a disproportionately large part of how they're remembered. Mm-hmm. You know, it's my uncle who died in a hunting accident. You know, let me tell you about my uncle who died. It's, you know, my aunt who died in the Twin Towers in 2001. You know, it may not be correct, but somehow the way we die is really important to those we leave behind, and that really needs to be honored as well. I talk about this concept of completing a life.
Yeah.
It's time to reintegrate that within our notion of full and even healthy living. You know, I think of the challenge is to not scrimp at all on the medical, but also to reintegrate the full personal experience within our concept of the American dream, if you will. You know, the American dream is, you know, you grow up, you get a good education, you get a good job, you have 2.1 kids in a two-car garage, and then you live happily ever after. Well, it turns out that there is between, you know, after living happily ever after or during the process, there's parent care, which many of us boomers are realizing is a normal, difficult part of human life, but not without its rewards as well, but it's hard and we haven't planned for it. And then there's the last chapter of our own lives where, you know, we don't plan for and don't talk about, but not talking about it just makes it a lot harder than it has to be.
I want to get to some of the stories when we get back from a break. But before we go to the break, I wanted to ask you about another one of these challenges that you write about, that mortality has become a politically polarized issue. I wanted to ask about the health care law, which is now, of course, being reviewed by the Supreme Court. I'm interested not so much in your opinion of the law, but how the story is playing out, that it, you know, it's become such a battleground for now these different political philosophies. I mean, what do you make of it? Because you write about how medical costs, you know, are eroding our capacity to engage in other priorities. So what does this case seem to signify about where we are as a society?
Well, this is a situation that is just – if it wasn't so tragic, it would be funny.
Yeah.
I mean, we're fighting over something in which we actually have more money than we need to do this right. We're actually expending, you know, a third of healthcare dollars in the last year or 2 years of people's lives and most of that in the last few months of people's lives. You are not getting enough on a return on our investment. People are dying in ICUs. 20% of Americans still die in ICUs. Fully 70% still die in either a hospital or nursing home. And very few people, you know, only 20 to 30% of people, depending on where you live, actually die at home, where the large majority of people want. We have the money to do it. We have the technology to do it well. But we're not even able to talk about it in civil discourse because end-of-life care has become radioactive. You know, no politician wants to talk about it. And yet, I work on both sides of or both parts of the political spectrum, and I know that people from the most progressive Americans to the most socially conservative Americans actually agree on 99% of what constitutes really good care for people through the end of life. It's tragic that we're fighting about it. And here's one place where the culture war is got us pinned down for too long. But I've come to believe that the cultural chasm that seems to be out there is utterly a mirage, that the vast majority of Americans stand on a plateau of high common ground between these so-called warring factions. I think it's time to sort of come out of the closet and say, you know, I for one, and I happen to be a progressive, you know, lifelong proud political progressive. I am ardently pro-dignity and I am ardently pro-life. You know, we have to take back the branding of those two terms. It's poisoned civil discourse about matters that affect all of us and about which there's frankly near universal agreement.
Dr. Ira Byock is with us. His book is called The Best Care Possible, A Physician's Quest to Transform Care Through the End of Life. You can join us, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take a brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, the Dr. Ira Byock is joining us to talk about the care a person gets or should get at the end of their life. The healthcare system is great, he says, at treating disease, just not great about dealing with death. We're talking about Dr. Byock's practical strategies for reforming the system. It includes putting an end to the culture wars, by the way. His book is called The Best Care Possible, 801-585-WEST, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. So, Dr. Byock, I wanted to talk about some of the stories you tell, because that's what the book is about mostly. It seems like the center for all of this is the family. I mean, you say that if you have a family, invest in that family. If you don't have a family, you know, find a family or find a community anyway.
I've been saying that for years. If people would write me, I have a website called bestcarepossible.com, by the way.
Yeah.
And people write me pretty commonly. And I corresponded with a woman about 3 years ago, and she quite literally just wrote back this weekend. And 3 years ago, she said that she is getting on in age. She has some health problems, but she doesn't have a family. She's a single person, no children, no siblings. And she asked me what I thought she should do. And I said, well, you know, get yourself a family, if possible.
Yep.
And I mean family as a verb, not just, you know, by bloodline or marriage, but people to whom you relate as family, to whom you matter and matter to you. And then if that's not possible, or even if it is possible, get yourself a community. And similarly, I mean community as a verb, the community where there's a sense of mutuality, that your well-being matters to me and my well-being matters to you. That, you know, and communities can be faith communities, which I hope we get to talk about because that's an important asset for people. Mm. If not faith communities, a workplace community, a vibrant neighborhood, even service groups like the Lions or the Elks or, you know, the Kiwanis clubs, the 4-H clubs can become real communities. That makes a huge difference. When people have a strong, vibrant community around them, we worry about them less, those of us who are working in hospice and palliative care. We know that they're going to get covered, you know, that people got their back, so to speak.
Mm. You know, when you're talking about – you always hear the term quality of life and what that means really. There's the story you've talked about, a fellow by the name of Herb Maurer. Who you talked about sort of epitomizes the idea of dying well, this idea of wanting to live as long as possible, as long as you had that quality of life. But it seems like also knowing when to say, I think the time is over.
Mm-hmm. Well, Herb, as you know, was an oncologist.
Yeah.
Frankly, one of the most brilliant physicians I've ever had the privilege of working with. No exaggeration. Herb was an oncologist before there was such a thing, before the discipline actually existed. And I worked very closely with Herb, and he and his wife, Letha, who happens also to be an oncologist, became good friends of me and my wife, Yvonne. When Herb was diagnosed, and he pretty much self-diagnosed his condition. He had something called a cholangiocarcinoma. He knew it was incurable. He had a Whipple procedure, big surgery. The pathology, unfortunately, showed that there was already spread at the time of surgery. He underwent chemotherapy and radiation treatments. Herb was not a wimp, and he was not afraid to use medical technology. He was quite an aggressive oncologist, and he did that, and he wanted all of that medical technology brought to bear in his care as well, as long as it gave him a chance of living longer and living well. Mm. He came into the hospital numbers of times to have interventional radiology procedures to unblock his biliary tract or cauterize some bleeding within his liver. Lots of procedures, lots of CT scans. Every time he came into the hospital, Doug, he made sure that his advanced directive was on file in his chart. He made sure he wanted one of those do not resuscitate, do not do CPR bracelets on his wrist. He said, you know, my quality of life is worth sustaining. But boy, if I have a cardiac arrest, nobody's pushing on my chest, because he knew that it wouldn't do him any good anyway. And so he didn't want to, you know, end up having his last moments of life having somebody sitting on his chest pounding on him or giving him electrical shocks to his heart. He wanted to die gently. Mm. And, you know, I have to just sneak in there for Herb, he brought real gut instinct to this decision, because I remember him saying to me more than once, "Ira, I'm still eating a full dinner, and I'm not pushing myself to do it. I'm enjoying it." Yeah. And so as long as he could eat and enjoy his meals, his quality of life was worth sustaining, and the next, you know, treatment that was being offered was still worth considering. But at the end of his life, when his quality of life, when he wasn't eating anymore, had no appetite, and his quality of life was eroded, then his values shifted to saying, well, now is the time that I want to die gently. And in fact, we helped arrange things. He was at home, quite literally surrounded by his family, people touching him and actively loving him as he drifted out of life.
Yeah. It's interesting, though, if you look at Herb's, his sensibility, that kind of calm awareness about his place in the scheme of things. What happens when you have a patient who doesn't have that same kind of awareness? And there's a thing that you write about in the book, the importance of the doctor as a teacher. Mm-hmm. Can you communicate? Can you reflect? Can you convey as a teacher, as a doctor, that same kind of sensibility that Herb possessed to another patient?
I can help. Hmm. You know, in what I do, and I talk about this in the book, and I hope I'm teaching it not only to patients and families. Frankly, I hope medical students and my colleagues in practice around the country read this. But I start by delivering the person from anonymity. They're not a patient. They're a whole person. Hmm. So I start every consult by taking just 3 or 4 or 5 minutes to say, you know, the medical records tell me a lot about your diagnoses. I know a whole lot from spending some time with your medical records, what scans you've had, what tests you've had, what treatments you've undergone. And by the way, you've already been through a lot.
Yeah.
Because frankly, Doug, if they're seeing me, they've likely been through a lot.
Sure.
But then I say, but I don't know very much about who you are as a person. So since the best care possible, which is what I'm committed to giving you, is not a one-size-fits-all phenomenon. I need to know about who you are, where you grew up. I don't even know where you grew up. So I start there, and I listen as if I were the speaker to the patient's stories. I try – what I'm doing there in actively listening is trying to hear the story as if I was speaking it, see the world as if I was looking through the patient's eyes. Then when it gets down – into our relationship or into this conversation with the patient about what are the goals of care, what, given your particular condition and the treatment options available, what would success look like now? I can help them because I now know a bit about their background, about their personal history, usually also about their, you know, values and preferences, which may be informed by their ethnicity or their religion. And I can begin to help them see, or I can at least frame the question as, if we were writing the last two chapters of a long biographical novel, the novel of your life, how might these last chapters be written so that it reflects your values? And on closing the novel, the reader thinks, boy, that was so wonderful the way this person left this life. We still have those two chapters to write. Mm-hmm. Let's make full use of the medical technology as long as it moves you forward in advancing your values and personal goals.
That process that you talked about plays out in a patient you write of, a Jerry Thorson He and his wife, right. Elaine, you tell their story. Jerry suffered from pancreatic cancer. And you talk about going through that line of questions with him, even talking about his religion and how that was affecting his experience of being ill. And you use the term that is the title of the book, Best Care Possible. You say that you're using that with Jerry and with others as a kind of an open-ended conversation. And this is what you say about it. You say you wanted the Thorsons to retain or regain the firm personal footing.
Right.
So they have some sense of where they are, and then this illness throws them off. And the idea is to get them back on that footing, I guess.
That's right. I mean, the title of this book came when I began to realize that I use that phrase and have used that phrase for years to introduce what I and our team here at Dartmouth-Hitchcock do with patients. Our commitment is to give them the best care possible. So I introduce it quite deliberately as if it was an empty vessel into which we'll pour meaning. I say, you know, I want to make sure that you get the best care possible. And then my next sentence is something like, in addition to the best treatments for your disease, that includes attending to your comfort and your quality of life and your family's support. So I've just told them in very broad terms that it's more than just their disease, that it's about their well-being and their family's well-being. And then I say, but in order to do that, I need to know who you are as a person. And who your family is, so that we're not just captured by the physiology and the diagnoses, but we're really looking at those in the context of your life and your family's life. It can be done. I mean, I do this day in and day out with people, and they get it. And that shift is usually a relief to them that the physician and a medical team sees them for who they are. And understands that this, you know, something like severe heart disease or liver failure or cancer is not just a diagnosis. Mm. It is a life-changing event in their and their family's lives.
You tell the story of Mrs. Maxwell in the book, and it raises an interesting question here. I mean, you meet with the family. You write about the conversation you're having with them. And again, you go through this process of asking them to tell a little bit more about Mrs. Maxwell. I mean, you knew that she had been widowed, that she owned a bakery, but that's all you know. You wanted to know more. And you talk about, as you're going through this process, suddenly this consensus starts to arise. Right. You all start to be on the same page. You know, everyone wants her to be comfortable, but they want you to do as much as you can. And then all of a sudden, there comes this moment when a niece speaks up, Cece. Is her name, and she says it isn't right just to let her die. Only God can take a life.
Mm-hmm.
And then you write about how this comment, you say, blew through the room like a winter wind. Talk about what's going on, because you figure, oh, we're all on the same page here, and then all of a sudden this happens.
Well, I knew, because of Mrs. Maxwell's constellation of medical problems, that there was essentially no chance of her surviving.
Yeah.
She had multiple strokes that were caused by infected particles of basically pus that were being flipped off of an infected heart valve. Mm. She was too sick to undergo surgery. Antibiotics would at best hold it at bay. So I knew that this outcome of this story was going to be that she would die, and that her family's well-being was really part of the main focus that we could bring therapeutically as a team. Cece's comment was a chilling effect. It had a chilling effect on the conversation because it firstly told us all that Cece was suffering, that she was grieving hard for her dear aunt, and it made the dynamic in the room such that nobody was now ready to say, you know, it's time to allow Maxie to die gently.
Yeah.
And we had a retreat and take some more time. That's a common phenomenon. You know, in palliative care, we say the patient with his or her family is the unit of care.
Right.
And although, you know, I realized that many, many, many thousands of healthcare dollars were being spent on Mrs. Maxwell's care, probably $10,000 or more every day, and that there are Mrs. Maxwells across the country in similar circumstances. in giving the best care possible, that's my commitment, it wasn't time to push the issue any further. Yeah. And in fact, in pushing the issue, you know, it's a little bit like walking on thin ice. You never know where you've gone too far until you're wet.
I
didn't want to lose my relationship and the trust that was building with this family. So it was time to retreat and say, not today.
So you give more treatments, some more time. And as you know, they don't work. They're not working. And so you get the family together again to talk. Things aren't changing for Maxie. And you say this. You say the biology of her condition is now making the decisions.
Right.
And you write this in the book. You say, is it fair to say that nature itself has declared that Mrs. Maxwell is dying? It's interesting, the word nature, because you use that word from time to time. You talk about how nature gives us gentle ways to leave this life, and that you use that word in these conversations. Talk about how the idea of nature, that word, comes into play in these conversations you have.
Well, I try not to use the word God unless a family has already used it, and then I will very humbly adopt their language and say, you know, or in your language, God. But I think many people are more comfortable, certainly with a doctor from a secular, you know, practice of medicine, using the word nature. But nature, or if you prefer, God, does give us gentle ways to leave this life out of the very best of motives, because we love our families. And frankly, because doctors, you know, care very strongly about patients, we don't want people to die. And nowadays we have this incredible armamentarium of medical science and technology to bring to bear to keep people alive. So, you know, while nature gives us gentle ways to leave this life, quite commonly we close the door to somebody dying of something, dying gently of something like a pneumonia or a bloodborne infection, or dying of, you know, being unable to eat, which, you know, all mammals die of eventually, of not being able to eat or drink. It's a very gentle, the physiology of dying because you can no longer eat and no longer want to eat because you're so sick is very gentle. But again, back to this culture war stuff that's got us pinned down, it's alleged that we secular doctors have some, you know, some agenda of that, that somehow it's devaluing people because we're not devaluing people's lives because we're not pushing to put feeding tubes in people or to keep people alive through IV nutrition and hydration. That's nonsense. In fact, there's nothing in Judeo-Christian principles that requires extraordinary measures of prolonging life. And I just point out to people that I can quote actual, you know, theologians who talk about this, but just notice that Pope John Paul II did not have CPR or mechanical ventilation, or medically administered nutrition and hydration as he was dying. And frankly, neither did Mother Teresa. Both of them, during the last few years of their lives, made extensive use of medical technology and medical science to live longer and live well. But both of them chose to die gently, allowing nature, or they would probably say God, to call them home. And these days, sometimes we're in situations not too different from the one I described with Mrs. Maxwell. We doctors, when we bring up the apparent fact that a loved one is dying, we get pushback. Well, who are you to say that? And we're going to Sloan Kettering, or we're going to MD Anderson. I would just say that every time we close a door to a gentle way for someone to leave this life, the body is forced to find another way to exit. And sometimes that's a lot harder.
Dr. Ira Byock is with us. His new book is called The Best Care Possible, A Physician's Quest to Transform Care Through the End of Life. 801-585-WEST, the number, our email address, radiowest@kuer.org. We'll take another brief break. Back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER and Sirius XM Public Radio. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now with Dr. Ira Byock. We're talking about his book, The Best Care Possible, A Physician's Quest to Transform Care Through the End of Life. Here's an email that comes from a patient of yours, former patient Sandra Morris. She writes, "There are no words to express the positive impact that Dr. Byock has had on our family. In 1996, my husband was diagnosed with terminal colon cancer. Dr. Byock's approach and counseling coupled with hospice made it possible for my husband to live with grace and even enthusiasm and ultimately leave a fantastic legacy for me and my four children. The approach, the palliative approach," she writes, "meant that pain was managed consistently, but it was the psychological approach of living each day the best possible that calmed his fears. Michael did not battle cancer. He was guided to take advantage of his last 10 months of life to live. And he did just that until the day he died in his comfortable chair with his cat on his lap and his family surrounding him."
What a lovely way to be back in touch with Sandra.
Yeah.
Michael was a judge in Missoula, Montana, and a magnificent human being who understood and was really grateful to be guided through this process of life completion. He had stuff that would have felt left undone if he had died suddenly. He really invested the time and energy and the emotional energy to completing his relationships, to celebrating life and reviewing his life, and as Sandra just said, to leaving a rich legacy.
You talk about palliative care and hospice and the fact that it really scares people. Talk about why and how you propose to transform that idea.
Well, I don't plan to transform it. I want all of us. We really need to come together and sort of reclaim the end of life. Right now, if you mention hospice to people, they say, "Oh, I'm not ready for that.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not dying." And that's sort of the mindset of Americans. If you mention anything having to do with illness, dying, caregiving, or grief, the American mindset is, "I don't want to think about it."
Right.
You know, people just recoil. That doesn't often become easier as people become sicker. Sometimes the resistance becomes more entrenched. And if you bring it up, it almost feels disloyal within a family because we agreed we were going to focus on the positive.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I want to focus on the positive. But given that we're mortal, at some point that has to shift toward how can we live as well as possible and derive as much value from this time of life. So people don't want to think about it, don't want to talk about it. And hospice, unfortunately, has gotten itself painted into a corner because through a Medicare benefit that was passed in 1981, in America, and it's different in Canada and the United Kingdom and many parts of the world, but in America, it's not even enough to be dying to get hospice care. Doug, you yeah. actually also have to agree you are dying,
right.
something which many patients I meet aren't about to do. And you have to be willing to forego treatments directed at your disease and hopefully helping you live longer to receive this comprehensive package of services called hospice for your comfort and quality of life. Now, I would just say that I think hospice is the gold standard for care for people through the end of life. But we're making it too hard to get. And these days, there are some treatments for late-stage cancers and congestive heart failure, for instance, that can improve your length of life and improve your comfort and quality of life. Hospice shouldn't be a barrier to that. We can change Medicare. You know, the either-or model of giving up one thing to get the other isn't based in some principle of therapeutics or principle of medical ethics. It's solely based in a statute that was passed by Congress. And it's a statute that assumed that if we did hospice care while we gave aggressive disease treatments, it would be too expensive. Well, now we have two decades of research that shows that even that's not true. Mm. That if you force people to give up treatment to get hospice care, they stay in the acute care system, and costs at the end of life are far higher than they would be if you had allowed them to get the right care and the best care throughout the course of their late stage treatments. It makes no sense, and yet we're sort of laboring under this difficult model.
You've said that that the culture has to, you put it this way, catch up to the new scientific and clinical power that we have to extend life. Do you feel optimistic about our capacity as a culture to evolve, to figure this out? We're still trying to catch up, but do you figure we will?
I don't know if we will, but I am optimistic. I know we can.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, my best example is I'm old enough. I'm just turned 61. And I remember when fathers weren't allowed into birthing rooms.
Yeah.
You know, that it was verboten. It was, you know, and I remember when the natural birthing movement was pushing against medical establishment. We, you know, there was worry. There were articles published about, well, is it safe to let fathers into birthing rooms? They could fall down and hit their heads, you know, and birth coaches weren't heard of. Well, just look at what happened. In just a few short years, we baby boomers transformed the way pregnancy and childbirth were understood and approached and care delivered. We took back the beginning of life. We said that the fact that pregnant women need expert medical attention does not define this as being primarily a medical experience. It is a personal experience that requires excellent clinical attention. Now at the end of life, we boomers are approaching those last chapters. It's time to take back this too. The fact that illness and dying require expert medical attention does not define them as fundamentally medical. They are fundamentally personal. So yes, I think we have the wherewithal of transforming the way we as a culture and society approach the last chapters of life without skimping a bit on medical treatments, with using the full range of medical therapeutics. We also can be, frankly, tender and loving and provide full attention to comfort and quality of life. I think we have to do that within the context of families and communities, not just health systems.
Let me ask you this finally. There's a lot to talk about, by the way, and you should get the book to see how Dr. Byock talks about education and coordinating treatments. There's a lot of practical things. Let me end you, though, with this, the doctor. About a minute left, so maybe it's not fair to give you such little time, but you talk about the social compact. It's not a contract, you say. It's a covenant,
right,
that we belong to one another. In the end, do you think this in some ways is a moral challenge for us as a people?
It is a moral challenge. I think we're at a cusp of civilization. And whether we consider ourselves to be just independent entities, you know, in a Jeffersonian universe in which we're all individuals, or we understand community as a verb, where your quality of life matters to me, your well-being matters to me. You know, my sense is that we can bequeath to the next generation or generations to come a civilization in which people are born into the welcoming arms of community and die from the reluctant arms of community. That's the vision that I have that leads me in my advocacy and activism.
Dr. Ira Byock, his book is called The Best Care Possible, A Physician's Quest to Transform Care Through the End of Life. Dr. Byock, thank you very much for the time.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you, Doug.
Radio West, a production of KUER News. I'm Doug Fabrizio.